This is James Corbett of the Corbett Report. It's the 9th of September 2009, and joining me on the line from New Zealand today is Claire Swinney, a 9/11 Truth researcher and activist and a member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. She also runs the Web of Evidence blog at claireswinney.wordpress.com. Claire, we've known each other's work for some time now, so it's good to finally get the chance to talk with you.
Very much so. And I'd like to congratulate you on the work that you're doing. I think it's really exceptional.
Well, thank you very much. And the work that I've seen that you've been doing is also exceptional. So, as I've indicated, you are a 9/11 researcher and activist. But why don't you tell us, in your own words, how you started down this path and what led you to take up this cause?
Okay. I'm a journalist. I wrote for what is now a well-known magazine in New Zealand called Investigate from 2000 to 2005. And I ended up doing quite a bit of digging and mixing with people who were fairly up with the play on what was going on around the world. One of them sent me some documentaries related to 9/11, confronting the evidence, and 9/11, The Road to Tyranny, by Alex Jones. After watching those and realizing the official story was a hoax, I then looked into the evidence that showed the official story was a lie, and looked into what this lie was being used to achieve, and was very disturbed at the manner the public was being deceived by the mainstream media. I got to the stage where I couldn't stomach watching television because it just made me feel so uncomfortable, and I started listening to some of the shows available at gcnlive.com, including the Alex Jones Show and Dr. Stan Monteith's. I also started collecting documentaries related to 9/11 and the war in Iraq, amongst other topics, and probably have amassed, one of the biggest personal collections in the country by now, I think. Since waking up to the fact that the official story of 9/11 was a lie, I've probably distributed a few thousand DVDs to people around New Zealand on a variety of topics, not just 9/11, I think. 9/11 is very good at waking people up to the fact that we've got a huge problem with government. And then once they realise that that is a reality, they're willing to look at other things that they may not have been willing to contemplate beforehand. I made a point of sending documentaries to people in the media, the mainstream media, to start off with, and encouraged them to share the information with their colleagues. Nowadays, I have a stall at a local market on Sundays, and if anyone buys anything off me, be it a bag of oranges or a secondhand video, I give them free documentaries such as Terror Storm, Confronting the Evidence, 9/11 Blueprint for Truth, amongst others. And if people don't buy anything off me, I alert them to the fact that something is very wrong with the mainstream media by way of a big sign I have in front of the stall, which includes a variety of statements to alert people to the fact that they're being deceived on a grand scale in a manner Goebbels achieved for Hitler.
Absolutely. Well, that's the kind of microactivism that I think probably has the largest effect in the aggregates. And I understand that it was your efforts in 2006 to get a local broadcaster to retract their falsehoods about 9/11 that started a particularly harrowing chain of events for you. So why don't you walk us through that experience and how it unfolded?
As I mentioned, I'd stopped watching television because it just made me feel so upset that the public was being deceived. However, on the 20th of January 2006, I happened to walk into the lounge to talk to one of my flatmates who was watching the 6 o'clock news, and I caught it being mentioned during an NBC news item on our government-sponsored channel, which is called TVNZ, that bin Laden was being blamed for 9/11. And because I've been listening to shows like Alex Jones, I immediately felt compelled to complain to TVNZ, as that lie has been used to justify invading Afghanistan and Iraq and led to thousands upon thousands of innocent people being killed. And if it can be done to them, it can be done to us. And I think that silence is complicity. So I and 10 others wrote formal letters of complaint to TVNZ on the grounds that they had failed in their responsibility to maintain accuracy in the news. And to cut a long story short, TVNZ in their reply maintained bin Laden was responsible, and as a consequence, I then made a formal complaint to our Broadcasting Standards Authority. That was on the 4th of March 2006, advising that I wished to complain on the grounds that the news item not only lacked accuracy but was an outright fabrication. I provided them with quite a lot of information to prove that the official story was a fraud, including copies of the documentaries confronting the evidence, 9/11 in plain sight, and 9/11 the road to tyranny. And they had so much information that there was no way, James, that they could honestly claim that they believed the official story after seeing it all. And particularly given at that stage, the story about bin Laden was falling apart at the seams anyway, thanks to the work of people like Dr. David Ray Griffin, Alex Jones, and David von Kleist, amongst other trailblazers. Paradoxically, the Broadcasting Standards Authority decision, which was dated the 4th of May, showed that while they declined to determine my complaint, they became propagandists themselves by alleging that Osama bin Laden's involvement in 9/11 is a widely accepted fact supported by the weight of credible evidence. This is obviously a lie. I mean, bin Laden's FBI page didn't even mention 9/11, and that was known in 2006. Consequently, on May the 6th, 2 days after this decision was released, I emailed their office and complained in quite a strongly worded email that I thought they were making a farce out of their obligation to serve the public. I also sent an email, I think it was a couple of days later, which mentioned that they should be ashamed of themselves given that people were dying in Iraq as a result of this fraud. As well as that, I'd been in contact with well-known activists in New Zealand, John Minto and Penny Bright, with an idea of staging a protest to wake people up to the 9/11 lie. And I'd been posting 9/11 related information on internet news groups, and I'd done tens and tens of posts. And while I knew I was courting danger, I continued my activities because I believe that doing nothing is ultimately far more dangerous, given the elite's eugenics plans.
Well, absolutely. So what was the end result of your complaints then?
The end result, that's a good question. In the third week of May, which is a few days after, let's see, where are we? No, it was during the time I was very active on the news group. And I received a number of veiled death threats via email, which included phrases such as, you are right about the assassination part, in reply to a question I'd asked. And there was also the phrase, I like to pull out my guns and shoot at moving targets, which is quite menacing, to say the least. And while I was getting these kind of messages, I was also starting to receive messages on a social networking site that I was on from a person that was using a picture that showed a man holding a shotgun. So I was getting messages from two different sources about guns, effectively. And I believe they were from the Security Intelligence Service at CSIS in New Zealand. And when they had their birthday party in 2006, the director of the CIA came, as did the head of MI5 and MI6, to give you an idea of how they tied in. And I believe they'd targeted me for a psychological operation because I was a political activist challenging the validity of the government's portrayal of 9/11. And I also suspected I was targeted because I started advising people that I'd heard that the pandemic would be used for depopulation purposes by way of the use of contaminated vaccines. And I think I just got the impression they were particularly worried about me talking about that because I had a very good name as a journalist in New Zealand. On June the 1st, when I went into town to take some DVDs back to a video library, and I always used to go on a Tuesday, and they would have known that, a pale-looking, clean-shaven man who was dressed in expensive-looking black clothing, he looked like something out of James Bond, you know, as the assassin, and he certainly looked very out of place in Whangarei. He came right up behind me, and there was no reason for him to come up that close unless he was trying to intimidate me. And so I moved a few metres to the left just to get out of his way. And then when the buzzer went, because we were waiting at an intersection, I walked very slowly and I got behind him. And when we got to the other side of the road, he just looked back to see if I was watching him. And then he started clenching and unclenching his right hand. He did it four times. And I was absolutely terrified by it, particularly as I was very conscious of the content of the threatening emails I'd received in the days preceding this. And I've since learnt from an Englishman who's been researching the activities of the New World Order proponents, that he has heard of these kind of tactics being used often to arrest people in the anti-war and 9/11 truth movements. After being threatened, I was absolutely petrified, and I felt as if my heart was going to pop out of my chest. I was just so... I've never felt that frightened in my whole life. And there happened to be a policeman, police superintendent, Viv Rickard, who was standing in the wall. And I told him, I walked over to him and I said, I believe my life was being threatened by the SIS because of my work in exposing the truth about 9/11. And he said he believed me, and he asked me to drop off a report to him directly. Anyway, following this, I went to my father's house, and which is far more secure than my one. I felt safer there. And that day I said to him, if it was between a man with a gun and tablets, I would prefer the latter. And what I was saying was I would prefer a non-violent death. This wasn't about suicide. And it really was not realistic to be thinking like that, because, you know, if someone's going to come after you with a gun, then you haven't got time to take tablets. Anyway, the next day I received an email. This is the day after confronting the man with the wearing the black. I received an email which I believed was from the SIS, because the contents included a reference to a phrase I used in my profile on the social networking site, where I was receiving mail from the man who had the picture of himself holding the shotgun, or someone holding a shotgun, and the Broadcasting Standards Authority. It intimated that the threats would cease as it appeared I'd gotten the message. In spite of this email, as I'd been so terrified the day before, I could not sleep as my adrenaline level was so high, and I only got about 2 hours sleep in 4 days. I was so wound up. So Dad and his partner took me to the hospital to get a sedative. I described what had happened to the doctor, who I see in the hospital notes wrote that he thought I was delusional. He prescribed Valium and Risperidone. I took the Valium and I felt a lot better, and I was able to sleep that night. And the next morning I felt well enough to go home. And I began to accept that the SIS were just trying to frighten me, and they weren't out to do anything more sinister at that time. And anyway, that morning, Dad was at work, so I didn't see him. I only saw his partner, and I spoke to her and I said I was feeling fine and I was going to drop a report off to the police, then I was going home. And in spite of me telling her I was fine, which I was, she must have phoned him, and then he phoned the hospital, because when I got home, there were social workers that arrived shortly after I arrived, and they were followed by a police car. One of the social workers said that someone had phoned and said I was suicidal, which I was not. It was on the 1st of June, I'd said to my father, if it was between A Man with a Gun and Tablets, I would prefer the latter. Now, we're at the 6th of June now, and I'm ready to return to my normal everyday life. And she said I had to come to the hospital for an assessment, and I could tell she had no idea of how the world really worked. So I knew I was in big trouble. Consequently, I asked if Brian, my flatmate, could come along, as he'd seen the threats, and he knew the work I was involved in. He knew 9/11 was an inside job, and he knew I was fine and not suicidal. Anyway, at the hospital, I was assessed by a doctor who didn't appear to understand me properly. I suspect English was his second language, and he didn't give me the time to explain myself fully. It appeared he had already decided I should be committed before I finished explaining what had occurred. Brian told him he had seen the threats and that he thought, in spite of these, I was fine now. Nonetheless, I was told I was delusional, suicidal, and depressed, and should go on antipsychotic medication and antidepressants. The hospital notes revealed that a nurse present had decided that Brian was delusional too. It was awful. It was really awful at that stage, because after you've had your life threatened, you need to be with people who will listen to you. You don't want to be surrounded by people who keep telling you it didn't happen, it didn't happen. And it feels as if you're being psychologically abused. Well, that's what it felt like for me. And I was forced to take antipsychotic medication, which I utterly resented. If they'd taken the time to really listen to me and look at what I was holding in my hands, they wouldn't have forced me to take it. The next day, I had a meeting with the chief psychiatrist, Dr. Zubran, and thought he would be able to work out straight away that I was not delusional. I tried to show him the evidence of the death threats and the work that I'd been doing in the magazine I had with me, which contained an article I'd written about 9/11. However, no sooner had I tried to get him to look at it than he just kind of snapped. You're delusional for believing 9/11 was an inside job, and those death threats are a defense mechanism, he told me. I tried to get him to look at the evidence, but he just refused. And this was supposed to be an assessment. I couldn't believe it. He started asking irrelevant questions about my private life. And after a few minutes, I got up and walked out. A week later, he did the same thing in the following assessment, if that's what you want to call it, during the assessment period. He told me I was delusional for believing 9/11 was an inside job. I tried again to get him to look at the evidence, and he again refused. And so I could see no way out of this. So anyway, I asked for a hearing before a judge, which took place on the 9th day of my incarceration. And at the beginning of the hearing, the chief psychiatrist told the judge that my belief 9/11 was orchestrated by criminal elements inside the US administration was evidence I suffered from a delusional disorder. And the judge agreed, even though he'd not looked at any of the evidence I had in the magazine that I was holding in front of him. My father was asked to give his opinion, and he said he'd seen the evidence and he knew that 9/11 was an inside job. But instead of questioning my father further, the judge said, "Oh dear," and then moved on to questioning someone else. When I was permitted to speak, I said what they should be talking about is whether or not I was suicidal or not. The two psychiatrists present both said I wasn't, without hesitation. And at the end of the hearing, the chief psychiatrist said I should be kept for 14 days for further assessment because of my belief that 9/11 was an inside job. It showed that I had a delusional disorder. The judge nodded, and the lawyer who was appointed to help me did not challenge their decision. It was then that it became apparent the only reason I was being held was because of my political beliefs. So that night, I phoned my editor and told him what happened and asked him to write a letter advising that I was not delusional and that a journalist's job is dangerous, and it wasn't surprising that I had been threatened because of the work I'd been doing. He wrote a letter that night, and I picked up 9 copies the next day on a home visit, and on return to the hospital, I handed the chief psychiatrist a copy, and I had one put on the top of my file for the nurses to read. And luckily, later that day, I could see people were looking at me differently. They were starting to look at me as if I was a human being. And also, fortunately, the occupational therapist said that she would organise a meeting with a consumer rights advocate in order to compel the chief psychiatrist to listen to me and look at the evidence that I had. On the 11th day, the chief psychiatrist suggested we go outside to talk. He again said I was delusional for believing 9/11 was an inside job. So I pulled out a clipping. I had this news clipping that I had in my pocket about Building 7's collapse. And I just held it in front of him and I said, this shows that I'm not delusional. And he just ignored it. And he said he would inject me with antidepressants intramuscularly if I didn't take them. I told him he didn't treat me like a human being, and then I walked back to the hospital. And it was when we met at the doorway at the hospital for the first time in 11 days, he asked to see my evidence. So we sat at a table, and the consumer rights advocate joined us as well, and one of the nurses, who told him that there was a consensus amongst my nurses that I should be released immediately. I showed the psychiatrist my article and some of the threats, the death threats, and within 15 minutes of the discussion with the advocate mediating, he decided I could go home, but I had to have home visits. My last words to him, as I handed him, confronting the evidence in 9/11, the road to tyranny, was, I hope that you'll apologise once you've watched those. And he just looked at me and he said, I don't think so. Yeah, I was absolutely shocked by what happened.
Well, it is a shocking story in a number of ways. Did you get your apology?
I did get my apology, but I had to write many letters, and I made phone call after phone call to the District Inspector for Mental Health, and also in the end, I ended up threatening to protest outside of the hospital. That was in August 2008, and it was then that I got the apology, and it was quite a thoughtfully worded one, so I was grateful for that. But I never got an apology from Dr. Zubran, and that's the person that I believe should have apologised, particularly since he had contravened Section 4 of the Mental Health Act, which makes it clear that no one could be judged mentally ill solely on the basis of their political beliefs. And the District Inspector of Health for Mental Health, Northland, she's a barrister, the lawyer she appointed to assist me, and the staff of Ward 7, including the psychiatrist, did not appear to know the law. It was just, the whole situation was completely bizarre.
Well, it's absolutely incredible. And when you think about it, just in summary, the system was against you at each and every possible turn when you were really the person receiving these death threats and these messages.
Yep.
And yet the system turned against you, mm-hmm. incarcerated you, force medicated you, wouldn't yep. let you leave. And then eventually you had to claw your way out, basically. Mm-hmm. It's really an incredible story, and one that exposes the system for what it is, even mm-hmm. given the supposed safeties in the New Zealand Mental Health Act against being prosecuted for political beliefs. We all know that that only depends on the political paradigm that we're living in and the prevailing power structure.
Yeah.
So I guess the question is, how has this experience affected your trust of the system, of the types of the doctors who participated in this, of the courts, of the basically the entire system that you were up against?
Well, it was a rude awakening, to put it mildly. And I've spent quite a few hours learning more about the mental health system, because I was encouraged to Take Action by the Patients' Rights Advocacy spokesperson in New Zealand. And she made me aware of the fact that a lot of people are getting locked up. There's nothing wrong with them. They're put on dangerous psychotropic medications, and hundreds are given electric shock treatments against their will. And some of these people have got absolutely nothing wrong with them. And it's really a crime against humanity that is being committed, and people need to wake up to it.
Absolutely. Well, it is an institutionalized system that I think people just eventually will sort of be indoctrinated into or will just accept because it's been erected around us. But but in that context, it seems to me that as we see 9/11 truth growing and seeping more and more into the public consciousness, we're seeing at the same time this colossal backlash from the powers that be with a flurry of new hit pieces coming out about 9/11 and a number of things in the mainstream media trying to portray anyone who questions the official version of 9/11 as being insane. And obviously you are the living example of this policy. So do you concur in seeing this as a dangerous attack vector against 9/11 truth? And if so, how do you think we can counteract it?
Well, I think there's quite an easy way to counteract it, and that's to educate the public about the truth of 9/11. And I think if anyone ends up in the situation that I did, they should seek an apology, and they should supply the staff with DVDs that show 9/11 was an inside job, not only for their own sakes, but for the sakes of patients, people that come in front of these psychiatrists, so-called mental health experts in the future.
Absolutely. Well, have you had any encounters with the health system since then, or have you sort of fallen off their radar?
Yes, I fell off their radar, and thank goodness. I did have a few visits from a lady shortly after I came out of the hospital, and I convinced her by giving her a copy of 9/11 in plain sight that I was completely sane and Dr. Zubran had made a big mistake. And she, on a return visit, she said, yes, I was blown away by that documentary. And she was quite critical of Dr. Zubran, actually.
Well, it seems there are real human beings on the inside of these systems, but it's just some people are so institutionalized in the system itself that they maybe can't even break out of that themselves, even if they wanted to. Well, are there any other thoughts that you'd like to share on this topic with the listeners?
Yeah, well, I think they need to be very careful about what they say to their psychiatrists or even their family physicians. I've been told how awful psychiatric wards could be, and I didn't believe it until I was in one. And I was one of the lucky ones. I got out in a few days. Hundreds of people end up being administered electric shock treatments, forced to take drugs like Zyprexa, which, you know, it's been linked to diabetes and reduces people's lifespans quite significantly. And it's, in my opinion, it is as bad as what Hitler did in the name of helping. And I just hope that one of the benefits that will come from the work of the 9/11 Truth Movement is that it will help the psychiatric staff realize that they've been lied to too, and they are going to be victims of the system as well.
So, Claire, do you think this is part of an isolated incident that was only pertaining to you, or do you think this is part of a larger picture that has some bearing on what's going on right now?
Well, there was a comment left under the article about this on the Infowars.com website recently. Someone wrote, "This happens far more often than most people imagine. I'm an outpatient therapist at a community mental health clinic, and believe me, I've witnessed more involuntary commitments than I can count, simply because a patient verbalized delusions such as 9/11 was an inside job, mentioned FEMA camps, or discussed health concerns related to chemtrails, fluoridated water, or genetically modified foods. If my patients mentioned these things, I have to be extremely careful how I document my treatment notes to avoid a trip to the funny farm. Sadly, though, most of my patients also see staff psychiatrists for their meds. Should any of them mention such things, they are immediately tagged with an incorrect or lifelong diagnosis. typically paranoid schizophrenic or delusional disorder, and more often than not considered actively psychotic and thus hospitalized against their will. So I think that really says it all. A psychiatric ward is a place you certainly don't want to end up in. So be very careful what you say to your psychiatrist.
Absolutely. Well, that's well put. Well, Claire Swinney, if people want more information on yourself and your writing, where can they go to find your website?
It's if they just Google Web of Evidence and Claire Swinney, that's CLARESWINNEY, they should be able to find it.
Excellent. Well, once again, I'd like to salute you for the excellent 9/11 truth research and activism that you're doing, and all the best wishes for you in the future.
Okay, thank you very much, James, and thank you for all the work you're doing. It's amazing.
All right. Well, thank you.